Today is Friday, December 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democratic Senator Al Franken gives in to pressure and says he'll resign.
Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them.
U.S. State Department issues a travel alert for the Middle East in light of the president's Jerusalem decision. There's also an unfolding situation in Lebanon. Also ahead, Starbucks opens its first international coffee roastery. It's all on today's International Edition. In response to Trump's announcement, Palestinian factions announced Friday that Friday will be a day of rage, while the Islamist group Hamas has called for an uprising against Israel. Thursday, protesters took to the streets and clashed with Israeli troops who responded by firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live bullets on Gaza and the West Bank in response to Trump's announcement. The Israeli military says one of its aircraft and a tank targeted two militant posts in the Gaza Strip after three rockets were launched at Israel. The White House on Thursday denied that the president's announcement on moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem means his administration is pulling out of the Middle East peace process. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
In the president's remarks, he said that we are as committed to the peace process as ever, and we want to continue to push forward in those conversations and those discussions. And hopefully, the ultimate goal, I think, of all those parties is to reach a peace deal, and that's something that the United States is very much committed to.
Trump Wednesday said he was directing the State Department to immediately begin drawing up architectural plans for a U.S. embassy in the Holy City. Joining us now for more on what this means is Shira Efron, policy researcher and special advisor on Israel and Iran with the RAND Corporation. Thank you for being with us. So what is your reaction to the decision?
In principle, theoretically, it seeks to rectify a historic wrong. Israel is the only UN member state whose capital is not accepted by the international community. And what's more, Israel's control and rights to West Jerusalem are not in dispute and are not controversial. The Palestinians don't have any claims to this area. And therefore, I think from this perspective, it's important to acknowledge that this is a fair decision. However, the reason that countries in the world have so far, and now we have a change, so far avoided recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, is that the international community considers the status of this city as a final status negotiation that has to be delivered between Israelis and Palestinians. The embassy is not going to move now. Nothing practically is changing. But symbolically, there is a big change here. Presumably, I believe that is why the president said in his announcement that this decision is not intended to determine the boundaries of Israel's sovereignty in Jerusalem. Those were his words. The problem, however, is that such nuance could get very easily lost in translation. And even if the embassy will not move now, and it will not move now, and even if the president does not mean to impose a solution to one of the final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians, the fact is that so far in history, any perceived change in the status quo of Jerusalem, possibly the most sensitive geostrategic location in the world, could have serious security and diplomatic implications in the city itself, in the broader region, and, you know, possibly even around the world.
Are you concerned about the backlash? And if so, what possible violence could we see?
We cannot project with certainty that this decision would spark violence. But based on previous experiences with Jerusalem, the risk is quite imminent. And while the Palestinian Authority said they will have nonviolent protests, we know that nonviolent protests escalates very quickly into violence.
Could this inflame a tense situation?
No question about it. And, you know, it's not just my view. I'm hearing reports that the Israeli security forces, IDF, Shin Bet, the clandestine service, and police are all preparing for that. In Jerusalem, the West Bank, it could also happen within Israel proper. 21% of Israel's population is of Palestinian descent. But this can also have ramifications outside of Israel's borders. Jordan's population is 70% Palestinian, and Jordan has a special role in Jerusalem. Even other other non-Arab countries, Turkey. President Erdogan has already said that he would disconnect ties with Israel following such a decision, even though it's not an Israeli decision. And we're likely to see the Turkish public demonstrating against this decision.
The president said his ultimate goal is still Middle East peace and two-state solution. Is there any way that this could promote that, help that, or do you think that this lessens the chances for any sort of peace agreement, which has been pretty elusive for years?
And because it's been pretty elusive for years, I think fresh thinking on the peace process after 2.5 decades could be extremely valuable. That said, it is very hard for me to imagine how this can be helpful, at least in the short run. Saeb Barakat, chief Palestinian negotiator for over 20 years, already said that this decision destroys the peace process. Another Palestinian advisor said that the two-state solution is dead now, and that Palestinians would now seek even more recognition in international institutions, something that Israel objects.
So that sounds to me like maybe that this would backfire.
There would be more sympathy. It could undercut the administration's own peace plan, which reportedly they're about to unveil.
Does this situation leave the U.S. isolated as far as any sort of a neutral negotiator for peace?
I think there are two parts to this question. In terms of isolation, while Arab and Muslim leaders are going to come out strongly against this decision, the fact is that they still need the United States for achieving other bigger interests in the region, primarily containing Iran. So I don't know if it will isolate the United States. In terms of the U.S. ability to serve as an impartial mediator between Israelis and Palestinians, absolutely. Jerusalem is possibly the thorniest of all final status issues in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. And for Palestinians, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, talking about Al-Quds, as it's known in Arabic, this is viewed as predetermining the faith of one of these final status issues. It's also important to acknowledge that this decision did not come in silo. Only in the past 3 weeks, the House passed the Taylor Force Act, which is designed to cut aid to the Palestinian Authority. There's threats of closing the Palestinian mission in Washington, and now this.
That's Shira Efron, policy researcher and special advisor on Israel and Iran with the RAND Corporation. Thanks for being with us. And keeping it in the Middle East, Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri rescinded his resignation Tuesday, drawing a line under a month-long crisis triggered when he announced from Riyadh that he was stepping down and remained outside Lebanon for weeks. Joining us now is former U.S. ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. You actually just returned from Lebanon, and it, of course, is back in the news. So what is the root of this unfolding situation there?
There's been some delicacy in Lebanon because of the constitutional problem, that there was no president there for a year, that people finally got together and elected a president, and there was some talk that President Aoun was perhaps too sympathetic to the Hezbollah. That's what a lot of his foes claimed. But one of his people who had been very staunchly anti-Hezbollah was the prime minister, Saad Hariri. Now, Aoun is a Christian, as the constitution dictates, and Hariri is a Sunni Muslim. Hariri, whose business interests are in Saudi Arabia, went to Saudi Arabia and then showed up on TV unexpectedly and resigned in November. This shocked everybody. No one expected this to happen. And what came out was that the Saudi leadership under Mohammed bin Sultan, the new crown prince, had asked him to crack down on Hezbollah, and he had said, I'm not able to do that, so he resigned. To make a long story short, via France and other people intervening, Hariri has gone back to Lebanon, and what we have is a strange situation now where people who are pro or anti-Hezbollah, pro or anti-Saudi Arabia, have all united as a result of what they see as bullying by the Saudis. So with all of the difficulties in that country, 1.7 million refugees from Syria, an armed militia of Hezbollah, tensions with Israel on their border, they're fairly united because of the miscalculation that the Saudi government has made. And I know this is very complex, but it's just an illustration of how difficult it is in that part of the world to sort out whose side anyone can be on when you have this Iran-Saudi competition. What does this mean? It means probably that in the short run, there's going to be efforts to try to solve some of the internal problems in Lebanon. But in the long run, these cracks, these fissures, the difficulties between Iran, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, and others in the region remain.
Does the potential for conflict exist?
It does. I mean, right now, people think that within the country, fighting, say, between the Christians and the Hezbollah, or the Sunnis and Christians and the Hezbollah, seems to be less so, because even the Hezbollah closed ranks behind Saad Hariri, the prime minister, when it looked like he was being pushed around by a foreign country. So never underestimate the power of nationalism, even when there's a lot of differences. There are still prospects for tension in the region that aren't made easier or better by this, and that is the fact that the Israelis have accused the Hezbollah of importing a lot of missiles into the country, and indeed importing the technology to make their own very precise missiles in Lebanon. And the Israelis may at a certain point decide that this is so much of a threat that they could attack. That most people agree would be a disaster for all sides. So there is still the prospect of tension, and no one really knows what the military result of the winding down of the war in Syria will be. What will be the role of Hezbollah, which has been fighting in Syria? Will the Hezbollah fighters come back to Lebanon? Will there be a truce? Will this latest kind of ceasefire, this latest pulling together around the prime minister, will it last? No one really knows.
And they've got about 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon now?
That's right. What we were told in the country is 1.7. And this is in a country of just over 3 million people. It's an enormous burden.
Mm.
And these people are not being integrated into normal society there.
Hmm.
I think the key there, as is the key, say, in other parts of Europe and in other parts of the region, say Jordan, is in the reconstruction of the cities of Aleppo and the other large cities that were destroyed in the war in Syria. There seems to be no sign of an international effort to come together, let's say the Europeans, the Americans, the Russians, even the Chinese, you know, to contribute to a rebuilding, which was actually the long-term way to deal with the refugee problem. No sign of that that anyone can see at this point.
And turning to Lebanon's neighbor, you know, obviously the situation that occurred this week with President Trump announcing the U.S. is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. What is your reaction to that?
Well, what everyone expects is that there's a very strong possibility of tension or even of violence. You may see that the State Department has put out warnings limiting the actions, not only recommending that Americans not travel to the region, but limiting the operations of its own since just before the war in 2003. That doesn't mean we're going to see a repeat of the war in 2003. It just means that the level of tension is very high and that there is a possibility that if there is violence, that someone could make a mistake, someone could overreact, and we could have a lot worse situation than anyone would like.
That's former U.S. Ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. How a dry spell has allowed winds to lash California with flames. An ex-South Carolina cop gets 20 years in prison for a black motorist's death. Russia says Islamic State has been defeated in Syria. And a young Afghan girl has lived in prison all her life. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Senator Al Franken announced he'll resign amid a growing firestorm stemming from sexual misconduct allegations. He's the second Democratic lawmaker to announce a departure this week under a cloud of moral impropriety.
I know in my heart that nothing I have done as a senator, nothing, has brought this honor on this institution. And I am confident that the Ethics Committee would agree. Nevertheless, today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
Dozens of Democratic senators had called on Franken to quit after a news media report quoted a former congressional aide as saying Franken forcibly tried to kiss her in 2006. Franken often struck a defiant tone during his speech and took aim at President Trump and Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who's been accused of making sexual advances toward teen girls and young women.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party. But this decision is not about me. It's about the people of Minnesota. And it's become clear that I can't both pursue the Ethics Committee process and at the same time remain an effective senator for them.
The senator's colleagues praised his decision to resign. On Tuesday, the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives, Michigan Democrat John Conyers, quit in the face of sexual misconduct allegations against him. Allegations of sexual misconduct have been roiling the United States for weeks, with dozens of powerful men in the world of politics, business, entertainment, and the media losing their jobs after women came forward with graphic allegations of abuse. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues with a look at the latest social media. And for that, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, it is almost the end of the year, so We are seeing a lot of end-of-year content from social networks, and that's what we are talking about today. So we start with Facebook and their year in review, which they release every year, kind of the top moments. As Facebook says, it highlights the top ways people came together on Facebook to support one another. And among the superlatives that they're handing out, the number one most talked about moment in 2017 was International Women's Day. They talk about Super Bowl 51 bringing in more than 262 million video views. And then some unfortunate incidents that brought people together. The earthquake in Mexico had the highest number of total interactions with Facebook's crisis response. Hurricane Harvey got a lot of attention and actually ended up raising $20 million in the biggest fundraising effort for a single crisis in 2017. And after the shooting outside of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, the benefit concert to help the city and the victims raised over $450,000 and received over 80 million views, making it the most viewed live broadcast of 2017. And then there are the interesting moments where people came together outside of Facebook.
Right.
Facebook brought people together in real life. And two of the big moments they highlight are the total solar eclipse, which millions of people in the U.S. experienced and connected and got to see it through Facebook.
It was like a non-political thing that everybody could enjoy together.
It was. And that's balanced by a very political thing, which is another big moment outside of Facebook that Facebook helped to bring people together for, which was the Women's March in Washington, D.C. Not just in D.C., but around the country.
Absolutely.
Marches on the day after President Donald Trump's inauguration. Exactly. And Facebook...
they called them sister marches, right?
Sister marches. And Facebook helped to organize a lot of those, people using Facebook to get together and to interact with other folks to organize those. So those are the top moments on Facebook this year.
Cool.
And then you have YouTube releasing their YouTube Rewind. This is an annual video that they do that shows off the different creators, musicians, guests, stars, all these people that have had an impact on YouTube over the year. According to YouTube, this year they had over 300 of those people in this video. And some of the highlights of the different things that have happened on YouTube over the year, including the song Despacito, which the music video for that song is now the most viewed YouTube video ever. It earned that distinction in 2017 with, as of this broadcast, 4.4 billion with a B views. You have things like fidget spinners. They talk about the solar eclipse as well, but also some of the tragedies as well. The Las Vegas mass shooting in October, hurricanes that devastated Puerto Rico and Texas. The end result and the end goal of this video is to show that despite all of the challenges that we face this year, people have come together and used YouTube as a platform to share videos, share funny moments, come together to help each other. And so that's what we see in these year-end lists on social media.
All right, Andrew, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, those apps on your phone are expected to earn their developers about $77 billion this year. Some entrepreneurs are looking to grab a bit of that market. They were showing off their products in Germany this week. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
At TechCrunch Berlin, there's an app for that. Whatever that is. The Jam Easy fits on a violin and communicates with your smartphone, turning it into a portable fiddle teacher.
We are like aiming, targeting the beginners who want to learn the musical instrument when we want to help them.
And this is the Gudak. Its developers want you to think about the pictures you're taking. Users can only take 24 photos at a time and then have to digitally reload. To make it even more like an old-fashioned camera, users don't get their photos for 3 days.
These days, we take too much photos, and it became not the memory, but data. It's tons of data you're making. With the Gudak, you got to be really decisive and selective, so it became a real good memory.
Good, faster.
But not everything on display here is an app. There are some other pretty cool gadgets on display, like Storybot, a little electronic toy that gets your kids moving.
So, this is Storybot. Storybot is a gaming console for screen-free entertainment. It makes kids play physically and play with each other. The idea is that you have different characters that you can put on it, and each character would have a different voice, different narrative, and a different story. And with these characters, children go on journeys, on stories, on adventures.
And if you tend to misplace your phone, there is the Safe Skin, a cover for your phone that's linked to a little square alarm device. When they get too far apart, the alarm goes off and the phone beeps as well.
We also enable this really fast alarming system, the gadget called the Eye, and if the two go out of a range of about 5-6 meters, the safety range, then both start to alarm.
Just a few of the hundreds of apps and gadgets on display at this year's TechCrunch. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, Starbucks is a giant in the global coffee market, and it's getting even bigger with the world's largest Starbucks store, which just opened this week in Shanghai. Faith Lapidus reports.
It was an event to rival the opening of a Hollywood blockbuster, Starbucks' second reserve roastery and the first to open internationally.
The future growth, the real growth, the engine of growth for Starbucks is going to be in China.
Starbucks is already a dominant force in China. With more than 3,000 stores, it commanded more than half of the specialist coffee shop market last year. At the opening of the new flagship store, company executives told reporters they expect to have 10,000 outlets within a decade.
The Chinese customers are embracing Starbucks, embracing coffee, embracing the teas that we offer.
Shanghai has some 6,500 coffee houses. The customers have high expectations for the new roaster.
This place looks more high-end, much closer to the original coffee roasting and brewing methods, and should be better.
I think the roastery can, for example, teach people how to make coffee, choose your preferred coffee beans, and control the degree of roasting, as there are various types of roasts, such as dark roast and others.
Cup by cup, Starbucks hopes to spread coffee culture in China. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Have Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Countering Hezbollah is a top priority for the United States. That's why the U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Nathan Sales, announced rewards for two senior Hezbollah leaders under the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. The United States is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Talal Hamia. Hamia has been linked to several terrorist attacks, hijackings, and kidnappings targeting U.S. citizens. Hamia leads Hezbollah's international terrorist unit, the so-called External Security Organization, which is responsible for planning and conducting terrorist attacks outside of Lebanon. These attacks have targeted primarily Americans and Israelis. The U.S. is also offering a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Fuad Shukr. Shukr is a senior military commander of Hezbollah's forces in Lebanon. He's also a member of the Jihad Council, Hezbollah's highest military body. Shukr plays a key role in Hezbollah's military operations in Syria, and he helped plan and launch the 1983 attack on the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Beirut that killed 241 Marines. These are the first Hezbollah-related rewards under the Rewards for Justice program in a decade. This announcement is just one part of the effort to counter Hezbollah's terrorist activities, said Ambassador Sales. Until Hezbollah stops using terrorism and violence to achieve its goals, the United States and our allies will aggressively target its terrorism infrastructure and financial support networks. If you have any information about Talal Hamia or Fuad Shukr, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call 1-800-877-3927 or send mail to Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Absolute confidentiality is assured, and relocation may be available.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.